To order, let the record reflect that it is 8:04 a.m. on Thursday, March 10th, 2022. As always, I want to thank our House Record Secretary, Lori Rowland, and our LIO moderator, Talia Ames, for their assistance here in the committee. As we start, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please make sure your phones are on silent. Present today, we have Representative McCarty, Representative Drummond, Co-Chair Hannon, Representative McCabe, Representative Puckettuck, and myself, Co-Chair Schrage. Today, the committee will be considering the appointment of Julie Sandy as the Commissioner for Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And then the committee will bring back House Bill 309, APOC Campaign Contributions / Reporting. Is there anything from the committee members before we start? Not seeing anything, we will move on to our first order of business. And at the table, we have Ms. Sandy. Thank you for being here with us. If you could please put yourself on the record and take it away. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, my name is Julie Sandy, and I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you this morning and introduce myself. I think I've been able to meet most of you individually. Just a little bit about myself. For some of you, you might have heard this before, and I think of said before, the confirmation process will resolve anyone any issues they may have with narcissism, as I have talked more about myself and my background this month than I have in my whole life and care to do again. But just briefly, I'm from a logging camp in Southeast Alaska. I'm a Southeast girl and spent my childhood in Little Naugatuck Bay on Prince of Wales Island. In middle school, I moved to the great metropolis of Ketchikan. I graduated from the high school in Ketchikan. And when I was a kid, we call it volunteering, which is a family joke, but really it was a forced march. My mom worked at the Pioneer Home and forced me to volunteer with the elders and the pioneers. And I'm so grateful that she did. It absolutely changed the direction of my life. I was inspired by the elders and the pioneers, and you know, they taught me many, many things. From being able to cheat at checkers or making sure that, the ladies would always remind me to never go anywhere if I wasn't in heels, a skirt, and with lipstick on. But also, the pioneer spirit, both having the courage to work hard at things and having a vision when other people may not be able to see it, and most importantly, how to be a good neighbor, even when you don't get along with the person you're next to. So I think all of those things really inspired me, and I've continued to incorporate them in my life as I've grown. I went on to school and got my bachelor's degree at the University of Montana. And my master's is from USC. I have a master's in health administration. I had a career primarily in healthcare. I worked at the Pioneer Home for more than 20 years, both in this capacity as a social worker in the beginning, but I think probably more than 16 or 17 years as the director. At the same time, I served on the governing board at the hospital, mostly in quality and improving quality health care for our community, but also as the chairman of the board. And running sort of parallel to that was small business ownership. Our family owns several small businesses in the community. We provide services throughout the region. And so it was an interesting opportunity, sort of in my day job, I guess, to understand how life in the public sector works. Building a budget for a state agency is very different than in the private sector. And so then going home and sort of hearing about the challenges of private business ownership and understanding, the pressures that folks who own small businesses in Alaska are under. So I feel like I have a pretty good handle on both the public sector and private sector. I also have spent the last 3 years on the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority and the Alaska Energy Authority. And so large-scale development projects in Alaska, and also the mission behind the Alaska Energy Authority and those large energy projects like Bradley Lake. So all of those things are what led me to the seat I'm sitting in now. But I would also probably say that I'm good at multitasking. So when I'm known in the community for sort of being the person running in heels carrying a bleeding child. My son isn't necessarily accident prone, but he doesn't have a very healthy fear of many things. And so I feel like I can multitask and I can run at a pretty good pace, which is good for me since I've been in this position only just a couple of months. I have figured out that running at a fast pace is necessary for this role. So that's just a little bit about myself, and I'm happy to answer any questions and visit with you guys.
Questions from committee members. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Co-Chair Shragi. What's your vision for DCCED?
Thank you. Representative McCabe, through the chair, my vision for the department, both, I love the economic development piece of it. When I think about opportunities in the state, things like responsible resource development, helping build alleviating some of the bottlenecks or the challenges that may be frustrating for small businesses. Most businesses in Alaska are small businesses. So I love the idea of figuring out ways to partner with the folks in Alaska who are doing really great work, getting out of their way and helping to encourage small businesses. At the same time, I can say that I had about 48 hours before I started my first, day on the job, and quickly saw that what I thought it might be and what it actually is might be a little different. So I recognize that there are challenges within the department, and so I hope to be a good partner and leader and help relieve some of those challenges, figure out some solutions. But overall, my vision. And I should also say, broadband is coming, and we just announced that we're going to be standing up the broadband office for in our department. And I imagine that will be taking quite a bit of our time as well. But so I think there's a lot of really great opportunities, things I'm really excited about, and then some challenges that we'll be working on too.
Follow up. Thanks, Ms. Sandy. And so the sort of other half of that question is, what do you think the biggest roadblock that you're going to have to surmount is going to be to sort of increase resource development and increase businesses in industry in Alaska?
Representative McCabe, thank you for that question. Through the chair, I think one of the roadblocks may be regulation, at least as, I take a look at one of the bigger challenges in our department right now, which is our division of corporations, businesses, and professional licensing. For lots of reasons, some of which are related to the pandemic, there are real challenges there. So some of it might be related to, the solutions may be related to just more capital in terms of longer-term solutions of new systems. But at the same time, workforce is a real challenge. So it's difficult. Our volume of licenses that we got out the door increased by 20%. We have a turnover at one point that was at 50%. So until I can get folks in the seats, it's difficult to turn out more work. Not to say that it can't be done. The division's done a great job of really maximizing all the solutions that they had at hand. But I also see real opportunities there to incorporate some shorter term solutions, because I think people are frustrated and I really want to improve in our customer service. So I would say right now, one of the primary roadblocks that I'm really wrestling with is workforce.
Thanks.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two sets of questions. First, you were administrator at the Ketchikan Pioneer Home during the time that the department upped the fees for the clients. What are your thoughts on that, and what was your experience working hand in hand with both the administration and the people that you are there to support in their let's put it bluntly, final days in the Pioneer Home?
Representative Drummond, through the chair, I appreciate that question and thank you. The increase in fees was heartbreaking in lots of ways. You can't work at the Pioneer Home without falling in love with the elders and having a great appreciation both for the work that they have done and the ways that they have served and built our state. So seeing the frustration and the worry from them was very difficult. At the same time, as a manager of services, I could certainly see we hadn't had fee increases in many years. We were outpacing, in terms of expenditures, outpacing what we were receiving by a lot. So I think the Pioneer Homes are a point of pride for the state. There's six in the state, and there's not another system that I'm aware of like it in the nation. It costs a lot of money, but I always felt that we were absolutely doing the right thing in taking care of the people that built our state. So I don't know that anybody felt good about the rate hike and the rate increases, and certainly having to spend time with the elders, having those conversations. And yes, and for some of them during the last, weeks and months of their lives was very, very difficult. But I can say, when in doubt, throughout most of my adult life, I can always go back to the elders and have them really center me. So even during the pandemic, the rest of us were sort of running around anxious and worried. And so many of them have said, oh, honey, we've been through something like this before. And then would give an example of, the polio outbreak and how the children in the community were brought to smaller cabins throughout the area and kept there for the summer and the parents stayed back in the community and worked. So I always really appreciated the wisdom and the sense that we'll get through it. So it was a difficult time, but I really appreciated their attitude and how well they handled it.
Follow up. Did you lose residents as a result of that? Did they move out because they couldn't handle the increase?
Representative Drummond, through the chair. Yeah, I think that we did lose a couple of residents who moved. I don't believe they moved out of state. I think we had one that moved back to live with her daughter. Mm-hmm. But I can't recall any that moved out of state because of it. The nice thing about the Pioneer Homes is nobody's ever asked to leave. So unlike the private sector, where if you're unable to pay, you can be given, or your behaviors are so challenging that the staff are unable to handle that, you can be asked to leave. And that would be so heartbreaking to have to tell a family member that they need to come and pick somebody up because we're unable to continue their care. In all the years that I was at the Pioneer Home, I never had to make that call. We did everything we could, even if it meant bringing in more resources to handle somebody if they were going through a phase where they were having really difficult behaviors. So I really appreciate that about the Pioneer Homes and what they offer to the state.
And just follow the final up. One on the Pioneer Home. You mentioned that there's not another system like it in any other state. There's a bunch of unique things that Alaska does that no other state does. For example, the Marine Highway is one of them. I'm gonna work on that list and come back to this committee with it, because we serve a unique state that can't be served any other way in certain respects. So I appreciate that perspective. Okay, my second set of questions.
Please.
the governor moved a bunch of economic development specialists out of your department and into his office over the last couple of years. Are there any of those folks left in your department? And if so, I heard you say that you were excited about the possibilities for economic development. But how do you do that if the specialists are over in the governor's office instead of under your wing?
Representative Drummond, through the chair, you're quickly becoming my favorite representative. You mentioned two things in a row that I absolutely love, the Marine Highways and the elders at the Pioneer Home. But also, that was one of the very first questions I had, too. How do you do economic development if the folks don't work for you anymore? So, but I am so relieved in working with the governor's office. I have a very close working relationship with John Springsteen and Matt Fagnani in located in the Anchorage office. So the economic development team located in the governor's office works closely with our department on projects and opportunities and really trying to find, it's in my mind, it's more like placing folks with the right resources in this community and in the state. It may not be even that they're going to be applying for services or that there's much that the department will be working with them on, but we may have opportunities to access resources and might be pairing them up with the right folks. So, but I'm working closely with those individuals.
And just follow up. Is Matt Fagnani the same guy who ran the drug testing operation a number of years ago in Anchorage? Private sector.
Representative Drummond, through the chair. I can't answer that. I'm not sure what his background was. Sorry.
His name is really familiar, and I think I could tie it into that. Thanks very much for the answers.
Coach Hannon.
Thank you, Rep. Shaggy. Ms. Sandy, your resume that's been shared with us shows you as the public board member for both the ADA board and the Alaska Energy Authority, and I'm curious as to whether you still are, or whether you have to resign those, or whether your department actually has a designated seat on those two boards and whether you would be filling those. So I'm looking for your, in the new position, relationship with those two boards that you've served as the public member on, because you sort of no longer get to be just the public member of anything.
Co-Chair Hannon, through the chair, I appreciate that. Thank you. I was a little emotional when I had to give up my public seat, but yes, I am sitting in, I still sit at the table. I am no longer the public member or the vice chair. I was fired at the last meeting in that I moved over to the seat that is designated for the commissioner of the department to sit on both of those boards. So I am excited that I still get to participate. Both of those organizations are fascinating and providing so many things to the state very, very differently and also in coordination with one another. So I'm grateful that I still get to be at the table, but in a different capacity. And by the way, it's one of, I think, 13 boards that I have an opportunity to serve on in one way or another. That's not counting the subcommittees or the task forces. So I'm learning a lot.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Representative McCarty.
Thank you. To the chair, I have two different questions. One is, in economic development, there's a systemic dynamic of economy, and there's certain basic things that is necessary, and then there's things that support and things that are peripheral that exist, and really, and as a pilot, I have a thought of just like, okay, just fly the plane. What are the basic things of flying the plane and all the peripheral things? And so what are your thoughts of what those systemic pieces and very foundational pieces in the economy of our state?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, you know, I keep thinking a lot about the mission. Healthy communities and protecting consumers while also really driving the economy forward. So when I think about that, I think about how there has to be balance in all three of those things in order for that to work well. And so the reason I think about that is I think with the challenges we're having right now in licensing, in my mind, it's less about one major thing that happened that caused the challenges. It's more about over time, perhaps we got off balance in terms of regulations. I don't have a really clear answer yet on whether or not we're over-regulated and that's what's causing the delays. I think there's a lot of things that are causing the delays. But so in answer to your question, I think the number one thing that's going to help us move our economy forward is having a strong workforce, whether it's small business or big businesses. So we have to get a handle on that. One of the ways our department can help with that is by getting folks working faster and by helping businesses in their licensure faster. So that's sort of one way that I see our department being really key. But at the same time, our department currently has $1.8 billion. I mean, since I started this job, I didn't talk about things with a B very often, but it's not million, it's $1.8 billion. I looked that up because it was National Women's Day the other day, and I wanted to, I mean, we have a really strong team of ladies, and I wanted to know how much money they were working to deploy for the state. I bring that up in answer to your question because I think that the grant funding that's available right now and that's in play both in helping the communities and helping individuals and helping businesses is also really key in answer to your question about what's basic, what's peripheral. So I think there's small businesses, there's other industries across the board, there's broadband that's coming, but mariculture, tourism, and then also the grant funding that's another piece of that that's at play in addition to all of the businesses that are sort of going to help drive the economy forward.
Okay, thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
So that's great. Leads into my second question. That is, we have in businesses, there's for-profit, there's non-profit. Some have very similar mission statements. One group of people want a grant that is to never be repaid. Other people are looking for venture capital to be able to grow their business. How do you see currently in our growth in the commerce and stuff to reach out to both those but have the expectation that you're growing the economy rather than getting just entitlement funds to keep a program in existence that may be working?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, yeah, I appreciate that, and the timing of it's interesting. I just had the opportunity to sit. The department worked closely with the Alaska Community Foundation prior to my arriving to deploy, I believe it's $50 million, and to do it really quickly. What I thought was, and that was to the nonprofits, what I thought was brilliant about that move, and to my knowledge, it hasn't been done before, was the department's acknowledgement that because of COVID, the nonprofits desperately needed the funding and they needed it quickly. And also just an acknowledgement that we were tapped out in terms of our ability to do that and do that well. So the department partnered with the Alaska Community Foundation and they did a great job in making sure, really vetting the nonprofits, making sure that they were reputable, they were providing services, and what kinds of services were they providing. Because of that, though, I just had an opportunity to look closely with the Alaska Community Foundation because we're just doing that last round, that last, I think, $10 million is going to go out. And so that was a really good opportunity for me to think that through in terms of what are they providing that's different that others, you know, that aren't duplicated. Are there 10 of those? Is there really a need for it? And then how are they going to stand up on their own after the grant funding is done? So I don't know that I can answer your question, but I think that I have a much better understanding now of the nonprofit and what they're adding to the communities, and also an expectation moving forward that as we're administering grant funding anyway, we want to really make sure that the grant funding is going to folks that are, yes, providing, you know, valuable and often really critical needs in the communities that other agencies may not be able to provide or communities may not be able to provide. But at the same time, we want to know that they're working towards being able to be self-sustaining should the grant funding evaporate. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Coach Hannon? Excuse me, Representative Puckettock.
What a motion.
Throwing at you.
Representative Hannon, you can take it if you want. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Potential Commissioner Sandy, I guess. Kind of dovetailing off of Representative McCabe's line of questioning as far as challenges that you see facing the department to effectively do your job. One of the things that you represented was a hurdle being workforce, kind of the recruitment and retention aspect. And I think that's something that, you know, we see challenging all the departments and whatever program they provide is that recruitment and retention aspect being a major challenge. And I don't expect a you know, crystal ball kind of 100% answer, because I think you'd find better work in a higher office if you had the answer. But what are some of your ideas to being able to solve some of the recruitment and retention issues specifically within your department?
Representative Puckettock, thank you for that. I often have insomnia, so this is one of the things at night when I'm trying to sleep that I'm trying to put the puzzle pieces together in my head. So specifically to our department, one thing that a very wise man on the board, the governing board at the hospital used to say, Dr. Johnson, he used to be my pediatrician, every time we talked about recruitment and retention, he would pause and make us flip it and remind us that the emphasis should always be on retention and then recruitment. I appreciate that and I think about it a lot. So one thing I'd like to do is to have all of the division directors, maybe across departments in the state, because I believe the one thing that's unifying all of us right now is that everybody's finally on the same page in terms of the crisis of workforce and workforce development, and how are we going to, from small businesses to nonprofits across the state and state government, we're saying we can't continue to do this, provide the services we provide unless we have folks who can do the job and are willing to work. So one thing I'd like to do is find out from the frontline managers what they think that they need. If it's just five bullet points of what do you need in order to retain the folks that you currently have on your team? I'm just interested in the information for one, but maybe it would provide really great insight in what we need to shift the paradigm and or shift that flow of folks that just seem to be, especially with the state employees leaving. But I also think there's great opportunities for us to change how we do things, at least within the state system. So we're working closely with the Department of Administration. Commissioner Verana is great about having a lot of energy and being really willing and open to suggestions. I think sometimes it's easier to say we're going to continue to do things the way we have because they're not broken. The nice thing, I guess, about being a bit broken is that it brings us all to the table in a way where we say, okay, how, like, if we take down the silos, how do we work together to plug the holes and solve the problem? So in addition to the emphasis on retention, I think that there's some hiring practices that may be causing delays. There's also, we certainly have some ownership of that through our licensing pieces. So one, as an example, when we talk about, you know, the nurse licensure, the compact bill is a great one from, again, I'm coming from the healthcare perspective, but because that would allow that reciprocity across states. So 34 other states have said, basically, if you have a similar license and you meet the same standards, you can either temporarily or depending on how it was worded, or you could come to the state and just start working. So you don't have these built-in delays before you're able to hit the workforce. I know if we use the example of nurses, that's a huge help for the hospital, for the healthcare system, but in terms of quality, and then also just being able to give the healthcare workers who are heroes in our community some relief. That also provides relief for our department in licensure, in that nursing is one of the bigger areas where we're having to spend a lot of time trying to get folks licensed. So that is an example. If you apply that across all professions, there's a lot of ways in which we could do that and do that easily. As an example, massage therapists or beauticians, maybe that could be applied for them as well. There are obvious ones where it wouldn't work. A Marine pilot in Florida is not a Marine pilot in Alaska in terms of having to do some real work in the field, understanding where the rocks are. So, I mean, there's some of those licensing agreements where it wouldn't necessarily help, but there's a lot that I think where it would. So we're working closely with the administration on some of the easier solutions that we've identified anyway that could help us. And then a statewide telework agreement would also be very useful, where we could say we've got a retired licensing person who may live in your community, but they're able to do the work. And could we apply the statewide telework agreement and hire them into a position and begin work immediately? So I think there's some short-term and longer-term solutions in terms of retention and recruitment. I'm hoping first we can identify how to keep the really key and valuable folks that we have on the team.
Well, not necessarily a follow-up, but going to kind of another thought that I think about all the time, especially recently with the idea that we're probably going to be spending a lot on infrastructure and capital projects over the next 5 to 10 years. Where do you see opportunity with workforce development within the state to make sure that, as far as the macroeconomy for the state of Alaska, that the dollars that we spend for that kind of thing are able to be captured by Alaskan workers? What kind of challenges do you see coming with making sure that that's prepped up to where we're not having to fly in hordes and hordes of truck drivers and operators and, vertical construction workers, everything like that? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Representative Patrick, through the chair, one thing I think of as you're speaking is housing, affordable housing. I think we've spoken about this in your office, but workforce development and affordable housing are going to be two things that the state will be needing to address, and they go hand in hand. So we have to have places for those workers, regardless of where they come from, to live. But more importantly, and just like you, I want to make sure, if we can, that we're employing Alaskans, that we're buying Alaskan products, we're employing Alaskans, and that the work that we're doing out in the communities is hopefully employing folks that are from those communities. That's really important to me. You know, there's a lot of opportunity through apprenticeship programs that we're talking about. I think that the Department of Labor will be key in those conversations about where we can apply apprenticeship programs or incentives, whether or not it's getting folks from the high school who are able to earn credits, who can come out of school ready to hit the ground. I know there's a lot of conversation about that. But other than that, I guess I don't have a lot of other thoughts about workforce development. I haven't been able to spend a lot of time with the team really talking about other ways that we can help develop that, especially in light of the infrastructure money. We are going to be spending a lot of time working on the broadband component of that through our department. And then, of course, you know, we're involved in the conversations, especially in rural Alaska, in the ways in which, you know, the pipe and the construction, all of the water improvements in water and sewer are going to hit. It's a little mind-boggling.
Thanks.
Coach Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. So, Ms. Sandy, this is not really a question about your department, but because you've mentioned insomnia and because you're from Southeast and because all of us who've lived here have thought about, but let's, this is my story problem. I'm just wondering what you think. Let's say there was a vessel the state was going to get rid of that had water and sewer and bunks on board, and you had a magic wand to use it however you saw fit. What would you do with a vessel like that? Is there some place you'd put it and put it to use for Alaska? I believe we're safe because I think the bids on it are already in. And I don't know the parties involved in those bids, so if you would have to excuse yourself, because I know that your husband is a guy who is always thinking of business ideas. But I think anyone in Alaska who lives in the coast who's thought about a surplus vessel has come up with some harebrained idea of how they'd personally use it. What are your thoughts?
I'm not letting Florida captain operate.
Representative Hannon, or Coach Hannon, through the chair, I appreciate that. And I wouldn't call it harebrained, because if it were me, that long ago, that ship would have been the new Ketchikan Pioneer Home. When we talked about challenges and potentially having to do shear wall replacement, where we would need to relocate all of the Pioneer Home residents, and we were brainstorming where on earth that could be. And then I kept looking out across the bay at the ferry that just was sitting there, and I was like, okay, well, and like you, Representative Drummond, I grew up on the ferries, but every time I go on the ferries, I'm impressed. They're really cool, and it's just a neat service that we offer. And I, if you haven't been able to be on one, I would sure encourage it. But I also think that repurposing those as perhaps employee housing would be a great idea and probably welcome in many communities, especially where the real crunch in those really small rural areas are going to come from.
Any follow-up?
Thank you. I had never thought of the Pioneer Home, but now I'm thinking of the mobile Pioneer Home that we move depending on demand and, you know, a new scenic view every day. Many of the residents at Pioneer Homes might enjoy that. Upper bunks wouldn't be so useful, I would think, but...
Mobile trades.
Representative Hannon, if I might, at some point I'll tell you a really funny story about doing a shipyard event in which the Ketchikan shipyard is always lovely about extending invitations to the Pioneer whenever they do community events. And it was one of those great events where they were going to break a bottle of champagne over a bow of something. And I lost one of my residents, and in heels, I was running up and down looking, and he had shimmied up the ladder all the way to the ship's wheelhouse, and I can tell, and his walker was right next to the ladder. So it gives me pause after that in terms of thinking about using the ships as a Pioneer Home. But it sure, especially in terms of emergency planning, it's always something that the Southeast communities have in play, is if we have a ship in port, if we have one of the ferries in port, what could we use it for?
Thanks.
Yep, Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This conversation has elicited more questions on my part. When I started out here as a representative in 2013, I remember being told, I think it was by the speaker during one of my first floor speeches, not to refer to any other bills except the one that I was speaking to. And I just sort of got the impression that you're only supposed to focus on your bill and how it works its way through the process, with no other bills potentially impacting it. But what you said about retention of employees, the things that you are standing up in your department, like broadband, the lack of housing for workers, I wouldn't be surprised if you ask your departments and divisions what they need to keep valuable employees if benefits doesn't come up. Apparently, we're the only state that no longer offers a fine benefit program to public employees. And there are two bills moving through the legislature. One to provide the defined benefit on a voluntary basis to public safety employees, and the other for teachers. but these are not the only employee groups that have this issue. I know in, I'm co-chair of the House Education Committee, and we are spending huge amounts of money on recruiting new teachers only to have them leave within 5 years because there is no dignified retirement for them to work towards. And after 5 years, they take their 401ks and the state's piece that has been put in their accounts, and they go to some other state that respects their futures way more than we do. So I'll be very interested to see what you hear when you embark on that. How do we, and it's very smart, how do we first retain the people we've already got and have invested in before we worry about recruiting more? So thank you. That was more of a statement than a question. But if you have an opinion on the benefits package that is causing such havoc in the workforce right now, I would appreciate it.
Representative Drummond, through the chair, you know, I like you, I don't know that I have formed an opinion other than an observation, which is certainly we are in a workforce crisis in a way that I have yet to encounter. The relief for me is, and I know I use this analogy far too often, and my staff are probably sick of it now, but when in crisis, everybody starts to pull together. So I often think about the Apollo 13 analogy because that just really reminded me of Alaskans. You can hate the person you are sitting next to all you want, but if you're hurtling towards the sun, you better throw everything you've got out on the table and figure out how to solve the problem. So what I appreciate about where we are right now in terms of workforce development and the need to retain and recruit staff is for a long time it felt like the Pioneer Homes or long-term care facilities or corrections, we were screaming about really needing help and needing more staff and needing really in particular a faster way to recruit and hire people into the department. But now if you listen on gavel to gavel, which I now watch for funsies, it appears that just about every department is saying the same thing. So what I love about that is I think it's brought us back to a place where we're going to be working together on how do we solve this. So one thing I've observed with the state is we often are spending a lot of time training folks up, I mean, in really valuable training. We've got great systems in place. So you don't leave the state system without having been trained in proper EEOC kinds of things, discrimination, cultural diversity, respectful workplace. So all of those things are trainings that you're expected to have on board as a state employee. But in addition to that, we really invest in you. And then what the observation is that folks move on. And the question is, why are they moving on? Well, inherently within our systems, we don't have, at least in my experience, I shouldn't speak for all the departments, but we don't inherently have a great way for like an apprenticeship ladder, a career ladder where we're really, the expectation is that we are going to grow from within and we are going to take folks from, they might start as a range 10 or 12 employee and by the end of their career, they could be the division director or the commissioner. So my question about that is why is that? That's very different than in the private sector. In the private sector, once you start to invest in someone and you identify that they're an amazing talent, well, you're going to do everything you can to keep that. It's not just about the wage and it's not just about the benefit package, though I understand where you're coming from and I think that that is definitely a component of it. So I'm very interested in having conversations about where the state or certainly our department can improve or find ways where we might be able to have the expectation that you could really grow from within. I understand college isn't for everybody, so There are opportunities where you can substitute. In some cases, you can substitute education for experience. But I'd like to see how we can explore that a little bit better and beef that up a little bit. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Co-Chair Sharkey. As long as we are on the theme of posturing for other bills and not to use your job interview as that theme, but how do you think the private sector, I mean, you mentioned private sector and private employees and how concerned you are with small businesses, which actually do make money where the state makes no money virtually that doesn't come from somebody else. So how do you think the private sector is keeping people, and how do you think they're doing without a defined benefit program? Oftentimes they just have a 401k. Oftentimes they have nothing. So I don't know. Maybe that's more editorializing for Representative Drummond than it is for you. But private sector businesses obviously are part of your concern. And how are we going to, how are we going to help them keep their people around as well?
Representative McCabe, I am so excited that you and Representative Drummond and like minds are wrestling with this and have an opportunity to provide this solution. And I am happy to be working with you on that solution. But because honestly, I don't really know how the private sector is going to address this. It's certainly something that, you know, our family is spending a lot of time thinking about. We get excited, you know, one of the companies we own is a construction company. And so that you would think that there would be a lot of opportunities coming in terms of the infrastructure funds and opportunities to build water and sewer throughout Alaska, especially in rural Alaska. But if you've got an inability to acquire the pipe because we have supply chain issues, and you have an inability to do the work once you win the contract or win the bid on the contract because you know, a larger company just came and offered your employees twice as much somewhere else. So it's going to be a real struggle, I think, for the smaller businesses in Alaska to be successful if they're fighting to keep their employees. What I think we have going for us is oftentimes people are loyal to our small companies for a reason. So what are we providing them that a larger company wouldn't? And I think the state is doing a marvelous job of starting to apply some of that to the work that they that we do through the state. So one thing that the private sector used to be able to do that bugged me running the Pioneer Homes that I didn't feel like I could do as well was things like telework. Before the pandemic, I can tell you there wasn't a lot of movement in conversations about telework. Some divisions, some departments were doing a little bit of it, but it was something the unions had an opinion about, management had an opinion about sometimes. So the lovely thing is, you know, I took a couple of years off. I was retired and happily retired. But when I came back to take this position, well, telework's everywhere and everybody does it and does it really well. So I think that there's some flexibility and ability to be more nimble like the private sector in figuring out what does the employee need and how can we provide that. And if it's just flexibility, we can do that. So
thanks for that follow-up.
Well, while we're on the topic of editorializing, I just note that in the private sector, I mean, one of the things we've seen in recent months and over the last year with, everyone is seeing these retention issues. At the same time, we're seeing a substantial period of wage growth, I think, in a recognition that while training and other flexibility offerings that we can provide employees do make a difference, wages and benefits do make a substantial difference to Representative Drummond's point. But follow up, Representative McCabe, and then we'll go back to Drummond and see where things go.
Thanks. Maybe Rep. Drummond and I should just go out in the hall. And
Commissioner,
wrestling tournament.
So you brought up a really good point, and before we got into the editorializing, that was going to be my question, was the telework. And what do you need? I guess this is probably the question. What do you need from us to allow you to allow your employees to telework more often? And that's, to me, it's a huge benefit. You can stay at home. You can leave your bunny slippers on. I got the word bunny in there. And your jammies. And just work from your computer. I mean, you know, especially if you have a computer-centric job where you're not having to go out and inspect and that sort of thing. But so what do you need from us to make that more of a viable solution to keep employees around for you.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, I appreciate that. I think my observation, you know, I could go back to the office and greater minds than mine will probably tell me I'm wrong. But, you know, from my observation in the 2 months that I've been on the job now, I think the legislature, the members of the legislature and the governor and the governor's office are very much in support of doing everything that they can to be flexible. That's a that's really something I'm counting on when I think about how do we solve this? How do we keep folks in the seats that we have? So I think at this time, I'm not aware of anything that you guys could be doing more than you've already done to help support that. I should say one challenge is the duty assignment for the position. So if the position is assigned in Juneau or it's assigned to Anchorage, if I've got somebody stationed somewhere else, that it may require more agreements or more processes maybe need to be put in place. But that's something I'll be taking a look at to see. And certainly you'll be the very first person I call if we run into a roadblock there, because I think that understandably so, I know from Ketchikan, when we have positions, state positions, those are really important to our community. We don't want to feel like we're losing those because those state jobs contribute a lot. You know, it's a livable wage. Families come to the community. So it's something that I know we have to be very measured and careful about when we discuss the potential of having folks maybe in different regions of Alaska fill that same job.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I just wanted to remind the committee that private sector employers provide Social Security to their employees. The state of Alaska hasn't done that since they were given permission to not do it because they provided the defined benefit program. And they opted out of the Social Security system, which made sense because it was a good replacement. But when they took it away, they did not put Social Security back. So that is a huge problem. Thank you. That's all I wanted to say.
Did you care to respond?
Only no, that Representative that. Drummond, I through the chair, I have been watching a lot of gavel to gavel, but based on how little I know about this exchange, I think I should be watching more gavel to gavel so I understand more about this exchange between you guys.
Trust me, no, you don't.
There's always time for more gavel to gavel.
I was going to get the Oculus.
Representative McCarty and then Co-Chair Hannon.
Oh, boy.
Here we go.
Through the chair. So the question, and I want to get back into you and how your thoughts in resolving this issue. An aspect of telework, teletherapy, telestuff. That I'm hearing a rise, and I've been dealing with it, in fact, even this week in realms, but not just from this week, where there's almost a movement of entitlement that I should be able to stay home and do work, and the employer can't tell me to come into the office. And you're really intruding upon my life that now I have to come into the office. And that's having an effect on the workplace where I'm hearing employers are saying, well, I need them in the office because whatever reason may be type thing. So what's your insight to availing our workforce or commerce to be able to do what it needs to do, whether telework or you know, having to say, no, I need you in the office type thing. And anyway, what are your thoughts?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, thank you for that. I have to admit I'm kind of old school. And because I was retired for the last couple of years, again, happily, and I was so excited because I'm not a digital native, which is what people like my kids, where they speak the language. I don't speak the language. So I literally was in a board meeting this week where I was banging my mouse and I couldn't figure, and they were talking to me. It's like the one time you get called on to speak and you're supposed to say something smart, and I couldn't figure out how to make it work. I found out later that the meeting was in the same building as I was in. I just didn't know that. So I could have just gotten in the elevator and gone down and attended the meeting, but that's an aside. But I'm old school in that it causes me concern to walk into an office building and not see anybody there working. So it causes me a little bit of anxiety, like, oh my gosh, are we really getting the work done? But at the same time, when I meet with the teams and have seen the advancements in technology and really what can be done and accomplished in a meeting, and sometimes much more efficiently, and especially as we stack my day, I can attend many more team meetings than I could if I was waiting to either drive across town to attend a meeting or not. So there's efficiencies that can be gained. At the same time, there are just positions that aren't as effective. And by the way, I don't think anything is as effective as a face-to-face meeting. So what I love about this time that we're in now is I think that we'll see a hybrid model. There's the ability to, yes, work from home and do some telework. And then there's also going to be some meeting face to face again, which I think is especially when you're building relationships, you know. So I see us moving more towards a hybrid model where it works for us, where we've identified we absolutely are gaining on efficiencies. The state is saving money. We're getting more work out of it. We want to continue that. And with some folks, you know, having to explain to somebody, if you're in customer service and 9 of the 10 components of your job description involve customer service face to face, that position's likely not going to be able to telework. So, and that can feel to some folks, you know, as if we're picking and choosing, when we're really, as an employer, just trying to demonstrate there are some positions that really are not appropriate for telework, but for the ones that are, we definitely want to be as flexible as we can be, but likely a hybrid model. And then the other part that the small business piece of me felt really good about is, you know, I love, you know, through conversations with the governor's office, wherever we acknowledge that we are no longer needing those office spaces, I think there's conversations that are, okay, how do we reduce spending in the state? I mean, if we no longer have folks who are going to be working full time in that office, how do we condense the offices so that, you know, if you're going to be working, if it's a telework position now, you don't also have a full office. Maybe you have access to that office. It's more of a hoteling of office space. So you check out the time slot, which is really efficient and a much better use of state dollars. So I love it. It always sort of makes me feel good because I think that sometimes the private sector worries that people in government aren't necessarily being good stewards of state dollars in the same way that you would be if it's you're having to worry about paying the mortgage for that building. So I like to see those conversations happening hand in hand. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel like I can go back to the folks that I know in private business and say, no, we're doing it right.
Coach Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Sandy, as you've explored telework, and one of the things is, you know, we leaped into it at COVID. It forced us to do it for so many positions. But we had not explored where that cost shifting was going. So now your division director or licensing board person is working from home and their phone costs have gone up, or they need to reinstall a landline or expand their internet service and broadband, let alone the computer that had never before been in their home is now going to be in their home, and the hardware needs maintenance from your IT division. Have you, as you're looking at the telework policies, do you know what that cost is going to be? Because we might save on rent overhead, but there's still heat being paid somewhere. And are you looking at policies that incorporate those costs where the employee now, instead of turning back the dial for 8 hours while they're away from home, they're going to be in their home 24 hours and working, is the state looking at policies of going, well, there is a cost to the employee to work from home. And the IT department's certainly going to have a much more complex job to maintain equipment in 50 locations versus a server in a building in those 50. So I don't know how far into the telework policies you've been able to delve, and I certainly hope that we don't have each commissioner doing that analysis for their department, that we as a state are looking at that.
Co-Chair Hannon, through the chair, I appreciate that, and I can happily say this might be one of the few things that I don't have anything to do with at Commerce. So one thing that's been really enlightening to me since I've taken the position is really seeing like the scope and the breadth of the department across the 6 divisions and the 8 corporate boards that are under Commerce. But to my knowledge, this isn't something that my team is working on, but I am confident that our counterparts, other commissioners are looking at it. I haven't had any conversations related to those costs, and honestly, it's the first time I really thought about that. But I'm certain other folks are. The one piece of it, and I'm probably being naive, but as I talk about and think about setting up the broadband office and the infrastructure money, as that's coming down the pike, this is really what I'm hoping will be part of the solution, not just in healthcare, but also in workforce, where, you know, that extra connectivity, especially to the rural communities. You know, I know lots of folks growing up in, you know, logging camps then, but, you know, Craig Kluwak, we've got opportunities, I believe, in rural communities of folks that don't have the ability to commute to town for work, but they have a lot of talents and some of them, you know, really extensive education could add a lot of value, especially at a time when we need the workers. So I am hoping that this broadband bill and the opportunity to stand up the broadband office will help us provide that connectivity to rural Alaska and really help us out at a time when we need it.
Thank you.
Representative Drummond.
This is a great conversation because it just reminds me of lots of other things. In the early part of this decade, the Atwood Building, where many state offices are located in downtown Anchorage, realized that if they replaced all the modular desk units with new upgraded ones, more compact ones, and looked at, I remember they looked at how many state employees brought in microwaves and coffee makers and were stressing out the electrical systems of these modular units that were never designed to handle that much power. They actually, that's a 17-story building. I believe they freed up 3 stories of space by compacting all of those, replacing and compacting all of those modular units. And they built a couple of cafes that had, don't forget about the mini fridges, microwaves, and coffee makers. And they provided several full-size refrigerators and a place for people to go and have their lunch and a couple of microwave ovens so you didn't have to have 40 microwave ovens on each floor. And so they have already done that. They've already reduced the real estate that employees take up in at least in Anchorage. And I know they were doing it in other communities around the state. So I'm pretty sure they can probably handle that again, as that was at full employment before we started losing people and people staying home for telework during the pandemic.
Always efficiencies to be found.
Or we could bring lunch boxes like my dad used to do.
There we go. Any other questions from committee members? Very good. With that, we're going to open public testimony. Not seeing anyone in the room nor anyone online, so we're going to close public testimony. With that, I'd like to thank Ms. Sandy for being with us today. The committee will take a brief at ease to sign the report. As a reminder for committee members, a signature on this report does not reflect any intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. This just moves the confirmation to the joint session. With that, we're going to take a brief at ease.
309. First up, we're going to take invited testimony from Nils Andreasen from the Alaska Municipal League. Mr. Andreasen, if you could please put yourself on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, thank you. For the record, this is Nils Andreasen. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. I appreciate the opportunity to comment on HB 309 and the bill in front of you. I appreciate the bill sponsor for bringing this forward. Well, AML hasn't had the chance to really dig into this and identify a position in support or opposition. I did want to provide the committee some thoughts on just how important this topic is. What we hear increasingly from local governments, especially at the local level or at the smaller community level, is one, the burden of participation, the real challenge to find and bring in local elected officials within communities. I know of many city councils around the state who are desperate for council members, and I think that anything we can do to encourage their participation, to increase the level of local government participation around Alaska, and especially within our smaller communities, will be a good thing. We were able to check in with a number of members specifically in reference to this bill, and they were all very supportive of changes that were proposed to ease the requirements that they felt were onerous, and to ensure that that you still have in place adequate safeguards, but that in small communities some of what was expected really felt very challenging. I think I'll leave it at that. I think this is a really important issue. I think the bill takes good steps to improve the system, and AML will spend some more time in thinking through what else is out there to improve the conditions for local government elected and appointed officials, and appreciate the committee's consideration.
Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Andreasen. And just for the committee's informational purposes, we do have Heather Hebden from the Alaska Public Offices Commission online. Do committee members have questions for either Ms. Hebden or Mr. Andreasen? Co-Chair Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Andreasen, it appears from data that we've been provided that the vast majority of local governments in Alaska, 136, have opted out. And that the legislation we're talking about affects potentially 30 municipalities, well, 25, because five are bigger than the population threshold. Why, I'm struggling with why communities who don't want to, why aren't those other smaller communities opting out? The law already provides a proviso, and the majority of local governments have opted out. So what is the struggle to opting out versus changing statutes so you don't have to comply?
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Nils Andreasen, Alaska Municipal League. Through the chair, Russian O'Pannon, to a large extent, it might be the limited capacity of some of these local governments. I think it's easy to assume that all local governments have, clarity as to what current statute or regs allow, and I know just how difficult it is, especially for small communities, to really know what steps they can or should take in response to state statutes. So it might just be an information gap that that we're talking about at that level. It certainly seems too that if so many are opting out, there's that's probably a symptom of the larger system that's in place. But I think one of the values of this legislation, for us, is that it heightens our awareness, and it might be that we have more of a role, and maybe the state has more of a role in communicating out to those local governments the options that they have.
Any follow-up there, Co-Chair Hannon?
Thank you. Mr. Andreessen, through the chair, have you heard from, let's just say, Ketchikan Gateway Borough or Kodiak Island Borough or North Slope Borough, Wasilla, Skagway? Are those communities that struggle to comply with disclosure rules? You know, I'm struggling to understand the scope of the problem and see many of the communities that Alaska has this very deep disclosure, and I think Alaskans have gotten used to having that information available. I certainly can understand Edna Bay with a total population of 43 struggling with it, but they already don't have to file because of that. But I'm not sure if you at AML, do you hear from local governments that they can't comply?
Through the chair, Co-Chair Hannon, no, I think is the direct answer, but also we haven't asked them. And again, the opportunity that this bill has provided for us to dig a little bit deeper is really, it's opportune. Those that we've checked with, we've heard back pretty immediately that they, you know, have had issues with how things are currently structured. And what I can do maybe is follow up on those that you specifically asked about and get you better information at their position.
And I'd like to next go to Representative Christ Tompkins, the bill sponsor, to see what thoughts he has on this question.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hannon through the chair. I think it's a good question. The first thing I would point out, and Mr. Andreessen said this, is, independent of the question of compliance, does the rule even make sense or does it add value? And the requirements that, like, Edna Bay population 43, all the city council members there are legally required to file PUFDs is, you know, a little bit comical. And so just, I mean, I think that's like really the question that I would love to center. But on the compliance question, I mean, we heard from the mayor of Nome in the previous hearing that it's, you know, a pain in the butt and it's just an extra disincentive to run or serve for office. And, you know, obviously a bunch of communities have opted out. There's some that haven't yet taken that step. And, I wouldn't be surprised if the list continues to grow, but I mean, rather than just putting that onus on communities, do the whole rigmarole of passing an ordinance and putting it to the voters and da-da-da-da-da, I mean, we can sort of save a bunch of people a bunch of time and trouble and sort of rescope the law so that the PUFD requirement applies, you know, only to the larger communities where, you know, I think there really is a public value proposition that when you have elected officials managing budgets in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, at that point, it probably does make sense to sort of have that PUFD level of transparency. So that's, you know, really what we're aspiring to. We're mostly just trying to cut out, you know, a bunch of paperwork that maybe has a questionable value proposition in terms of public benefit, but creates a lot of hair pulling and headache for various people. And I think I would just add, it might be helpful to hear from Ms. Hebden too, but my hunch would be that there's that APOC spends some time sort of chasing down Edna Bay City Council members or Selawik City Council members to fill out their PUFDs and what stocks they own, what the balance on their mortgage is, and, you know, what their annual income from various sources is, so on and so forth. You know, because, you know, technically, they have to get all the Selawik council members or all the Nome city council members or whatnot, and that there's kind of a mutually time-consuming cycle there between the regulating agency and those subject to the PUFD requirement.
And Ms. Hebden, would you care to weigh in on this issue?
Thank you. Chair Shragi, Heather Hebden, Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. I think I would probably echo many of those thoughts from Representative Price Tompkins. These smaller communities especially, and the ones that are more remote, what we find is it's the continual cycle. So they've got these council members perhaps that are serving in a volunteer capacity. And many of them come and go. They're not fulfilling a full term, so that cycle is one thing. They have to file an initial statement, then they have to file an annual statement. They also have to file a final statement. And when they're holding these positions for less than, you know, a 3-year term, it's just a constant cycle of trying to communicate with these clerks that many of them aren't working in the office. Or have limited hours in an office. Many of them don't have an office. They struggle with consistent mail service to these communities. They have very limited connectivity. So many of these people are just filling out a paper form and filing it with their clerk. And really the clerk is the only person that's seeing these forms. We're not getting requests for copies of the statements. They're not published anywhere. And these are the communities that continually struggle and are quite disadvantaged when it comes to civil penalties for late filing. And this is really the problem that we're trying to address, these small communities that are at a disadvantage and disproportionately penalized for these late filings. I know that Representative Hannon, I believe, mentioned the North Slope Borough, and I know that there is a lot of money that flows through that particular borough, but they are a community that continues to struggle to meet these requirements, and I think a lot of that is just the vast distance between many of the communities there and these smaller areas where their council members or planning and zoning members might reside have very limited connectivity as well. So I understand the nature of the North Slope Borough and the money that flows through there, and it might serve a community purpose, but again, people aren't requesting copies of these statements. I don't know that it's serving a public interest having them go through this.
A follow-up, Coacher Hannon?
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Hebden, can you clarify, because I used an example from the spreadsheet that you provided us, and I chose the bottom of the list, Edna Bay, without noting that the asterisks at the bottom say that those candidates under Edna Bay is asterisks as it AS-1513, they are not regulated. So this spreadsheet that you provided us, the bottom swath of under 1,000 population are not required to do a POFD filing. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the bottom swath, those in communities of less than 1,000, their candidates are not required to file POFD statements at the time they submit their nominating petitions to run for office. But once appointed to office, they are required to file.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up.
Follow-up.
So, if I go to the smallest community that requires both the candidate and the elected to file, it happens to be one of the communities I represent, Skagway, which has been a first-class city in the state, well, actually, far longer than the state, for over 100 years. They are one of the first organized cities because they're a gold rush town. I have no problem cutting the line between the 1,000 population and the under 1,000. I certainly see the need and struggle in a small community. But in the Skagway community, I would feel hesitant to say this information is no longer provided. A lot of those people in that community, whether they're not asking me to change this law. So I'm curious, because we keep lumping them all together, very functional first-class cities with the circumstances where they don't have them. So can you tell us, the bill as proposed has a 15,000 population cutoff. And for me, when I look at the list, I do see a distinct difference between governments we're dealing with all the time that have hired professional staff, city managers, etc., and the communities that would be a struggle. So I don't, you know, 15,000 seems like a pretty high threshold for me when we see the list in line above them, especially when a community like Skagway as a first-class municipality could choose to pass an ordinance and opt out. So drill down for me on the communities that are struggling with this to see where that population break is.
Ms. Hebden?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I guess as far as drawing a line in the sand, as far as a population threshold, I don't have a good answer there. That is, I would think, a policy call for the legislature to make. I can simply reiterate my previous concerns, is that these smaller areas, as noted, and especially the communities of less than 1,000 continually struggle. As far as the more sophisticated areas, I would agree that they have capabilities. I can't say that they continue to, that they necessarily meet their requirements any better, because many of these in the population from 15,000 down to 1,000 continue to struggle. I believe APOC is probably very low on the radar with the clerk's office, and because it requires a certain coordination level between our office and the clerk's office, who incidentally should be the official record holder of all these statements, it's just a constant cycle, it seems like.
I'd like to give Representative Christ Tompkins an opportunity to weigh in on this.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think to add to Ms. Hebden's comments, I mean, I guess it's just a question of, you know, what makes sense is the default, and, you know, should the state be putting forward this mandate for all communities when, you know, there's been sort of manifestly very minimal interest, at least based on people inquiring about PUFDs with APOC, or, you know, allow each community to sort of figure out what makes sense for them from a PUFD basis, and just like, I guess what the default should be, and whether, you know, the state should set a mandate as the default for communities, or let communities to sort of self-determine what makes sense for them. And I guess the thought here is more the latter approach, especially in the absence of there being a lot of engagement, compliance, or interest in the mandate that we have put on the books. I mean, clearly the behavior is, most people have found that this is not really worth the hassle.
All right, next up we're going to go to Representative McCarty.
Thank you, through the chair. So I always go back to premise. What's the whole premise of this in the first place? And it's my understanding is to have transparency of the integrity of candidates. And seen in some of our communities, and I know I lived in a small community of Kodiak, and there's things I would share with someone one day, and it'd be all over Kodiak the next day. And we had a testimony from former mayor of Nome, who was stating the same type of thing, that people know each other's business in these small communities. And so a number of 1,000 or less doesn't necessitate that, you know, ability to know our neighbors in the village, and maybe they know a lot more about you than you know of yourself. So the question that comes up is, one, the 15,000 number seems to be something that you're seeing as a problem, and how do you see that as the problem? And the second question is a twofold for this piece. One is, you see a problem in the system of getting information there, and I quickly liken it to when I led an expedition. We were after the Grand Canyon, and I got to a certain place and sent out a letter, and it was mailed out by mule. And so it took a while to get out of the Grand Canyon and get to the destination. And so is situations are just kind of struggle there to get out to a village. And then the other piece of this is this inhibiting viable candidates that are well known in the community from even throwing their name into the process of being someone representing their community, because it's just imposing.
Representative McCarty, is that a question maybe for the bill sponsor?
Yes.
Representative Christ Tompkins?
Yeah, Representative McCarty, through the chair, could you just maybe restate the question once more just to make sure I'm tracking it?
So there's three parts of the question. One is I'm hearing the 15,000 is a number that you're seeing that is becoming intrusive. I wrote down the words, continue to struggle with POFD in that category of populations of 15,000 or less. And why or how do you see that is that magic number? And the second part is, how is this becoming intrusive, whether it be, and it's already kind of explained by the system of mail or communicating to different entities, but also how is it be intrusive to allow for viable people in the community to be candidates of positions?
Yeah, thank you, Representative McCarty, through the chair. I can speak to those two questions and also would love to defer to Mr. Andreasen for further comment or elaboration as well. On the first question, I mean, that's really a policy call, and, you know, very excited to engage with the committee on other thoughts. I mean, it ultimately a line sort of needs to get drawn somewhere. I mean, right now the line is at 1,000. I mean, the thought would be 15,000 based on what APOC has seen in terms of compliance and, you know, public interest, and just thinking about sort of the size of government, you know, maybe it should be 10,000, you know, maybe it, you know, whatever. But at least my thinking is substantially higher makes sense based on what both people in these smaller communities have seen, you know, per the mayor of Nome's testimony, per Clay Walker and the Denali Borough's testimony, per Mr. Andreasen's comments, and also what APOC has seen as the regulator. So at least from my perspective, it makes sense to bump it up, you know, quite a bit. So you're just capturing the sort of larger, bigger municipalities that are, you know, maybe managing a lot more money. But yeah, ultimately a policy call on the first question. And then so the second question, I mean, you know, how or in what ways is this an inhibition for people running for office? And I again would love to, Mr. Andreasen is closer to that than me, but I would, you know, again cite the testimony from the mayor of Nome and Mr. Walker, who submitted written testimony, and I'm sure, you know, a lot more sort of testimony and anecdotes could be produced in addition to those two if that were helpful. But I think they both have commented, you know, it's a little bit, you know, in a little bit invasive, and it takes some time. It's just an extra thing. It's an extra hassle. I think the idea is that can be a disincentive to people who are thinking about running for office. And I would just add it actually that the law also includes those appointed to office. So if you serve on the Planning Commission, for instance, that's the under the definition of an appointed municipal officer, you're also subject to a PUFD. So at present, you know, I don't know if City of Kotzebue has a Planning Commission, but if they do, and if any of you or I sat on the City of Kotzebue Planning Commission, which is, you know, an appointed body in the City of Kotzebue, you too would be required to fill out an annual POFD, or anybody on the, you know, City of Unalaska Planning Commission, for instance. So the scope of this is, you know, City Council, but it's also, you know, non-elected officials every year are required to fill out a PUFD. Every year, APOC is required to collect those and chase down the people who haven't and do the whole rigmarole. So, I mean, it's just worth noting that, you know, that it's the scope of this is you know, a lot of people are affected and sitting down and producing a lot of paperwork. And I guess just the question is, like, is it, to what end? Is it worth it?
Okay, next up, I'd like to go to Mr. Andreasen so he has an opportunity to weigh in.
Yeah, thank you. For the record, Nils Andreasen, Alaska Municipal League. I think maybe to address the questions both from Coach Johannan and Representative McCarty, I think it's important to think about just how diverse that group of communities on the spreadsheet are. And population is one factor, but class of city or borough is important. Toll revenue and responsibilities is important. Representative Hannon mentioned Kodiak Island Borough as a second-class borough has some limited responsibilities, but also a huge geographic area to respond to and communicate out with assembly members. Same for Lake and Peninsula Borough, Northwest Arctic Borough, a home rule borough, but a hugely diverse and extensive a range of communities to be reaching out to. To the extent that communities haven't identified this as a challenge, one, it's because they follow the law, and two, it's because they prioritize their communications to the legislature. And if I think back at the last few years, from a public health and economic crisis to Alaska Marine Highway System issues to Port and Harbor investments, and so many other challenges that are very significant challenges that are facing communities, following through on reporting requirements isn't maybe necessarily going to rise to the top of their communications to the legislature. I do think, again, and maybe just to continue to emphasize the point, the more we add to the list of things that local governments need to comply with, the less the greater we reduce their ability to respond to all the other priorities that that are out there. And for clerks who are trying to manage this paperwork flow, communicating out to their council or assembly members and responding back to APOC in the state, keep in mind that they're also often the bookkeeper and they're also managing municipal elections and REAA elections, and they're meeting council and assembly, or they're managing a council and assembly meeting that could be, you know, once a week to once a month, but are often and substantial. So I think the greater we can do it, the more we can do a good job of reducing the obligations they have, even as we, you know, expect compliance on so many other fronts, I think that's a good thing. I think we want local governments to be stronger. This improves their ability to focus on the things that matter. You know, for something that maybe doesn't have the significance or value that other things like public safety and education and elections and transportation and economic development do, I'd like to keep local governments focused on those priorities and hope that this we can see some change here to improve things otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Andreasen. Next up, we'll go to Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Co-Chair Sharkey. So I have two questions for the maker of the bill. Number one, Fairbanks City is listed as an opt-out. They have 31,668. Would this put them back into the requirement to report the POFD?
Representative Christ-Tompkins?
Yeah, Representative McCabe, through the chair, the way the law is written, including the way the law would be written if this legislation passes into law, is that
communities that have already opted out, even if they're above the population threshold, would continue to be opted out. So the answer in the case of the city of Fairbanks at, you know, 30,000 plus people that has already elected to opt out is that that would remain unaffected, and the city of Fairbanks has already, you know, had that public vote and passed that ordinance or whatever and opted out, and that would remain unchanged.
Follow up, Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Rep. Christ Tompkins. I appreciate that. And through the chair, so that brings up the next question, which is the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, the Kodiak Borough, would, and the North Slope Borough, would seem to be boroughs that we would want to capture because they encompass a bunch of small villages and they are widely spread out, and the 15,000 threshold would allow them to be exempted. But we were just talking earlier about, you know, if somebody from Yuzinki is running for the Kodiak Island Borough and I live in Kodiak, I might not know that person, so I might not have an idea if he's, if his lifestyle changes significantly, or if he starts driving an Escalade around the couple miles of streets in Yuzinki. Point being is, it would seem like this threshold, as you said, was meant to disallow smaller cities where we know our neighbors, so they wouldn't have to provide a, you know, a POFD, because we're going to know if their lifestyle changes, if they become millionaires or whatever. And yet, in the case of Ketchikan, Gateway, Kodiak, and North Slope, they, the borough elections, they're so widely spread out with so many villages that, well, maybe not Ketchikan, but Kodiak and North Slope for sure. So, anyways, that's my question: is the 15,000 threshold would seem to sort of change the paradigm of what you're trying to do with this bill, I guess.
Representative Christ Tompkins.
Yeah, Representative McCabe, through the chair, that's an accurate analysis. And I mean, if it made sense to the committee, and you know, we wanted to modify that threshold to 10,000 instead of 15,000, and thereby capture some of these, I guess you'd say, sort of medium-sized, at least by Alaska standards, boroughs, including Ketchikan, Kodiak, and North Slope, that would do the trick, and I wouldn't be opposed to such an amendment. So, I mean, I think there's merit there. I mean, I think the real goal here is for the, you know, starting to get to smaller communities, try to sort of free them up from these reporting requirements. But, you know, if moving the threshold to, say, 10,000 in order to capture those boroughs appeal to the committee, I certainly wouldn't be opposed.
Okay, next up, Representative Buckduck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the sponsor of the bill, and kind of dovetailing on the conversation that Representative Cave is going to as far as the population threshold. You know, I understand the checks and balances that a POFD provides for a community that's dealing with a lot of money. And having been a prior North Slope Borough Assemblyman, I always thought that it was okay to do that. I didn't know that we were, I guess, potentially exempted from it. So some of my questions, I think, going down to the boards and commissions, right, and we, for example, within the Borough Assembly, we appointed investment committee members that dealt with our geobonding up to 75 to 150 million annually. We dealt with investment committee members that dealt with our permanent fund, which is now just over $1 billion. And for boards and commissions like that, I would see that it's diligent to have that that disclosure in place. But we also had Inupiat Heritage and Learning Center boards and commissions that dealt with the use of our traditional room from community members and things that are less financial in nature, where I could see that it becomes a cumbersome, almost, I don't want to say useless, but thing that you would have to continually keep up with as being that board and commission member. So with the way the bill is written now at 15,000, it was my understanding from the last meeting that those that fall under have the opportunity to opt in to, you know, filing POFDs. And that's fine for the financial reasons that I just talked about. But is there any kind of hybrid opportunity for the, in my case, the borough, the North Slope borough, to pick and choose kind of the boards and commissions that would have to file a POFD, since our whole requirement to file a POFD is optional anyway? And is that something that has been taken into consideration?
Maybe I'll go first to the bill sponsor, Representative Christ Tompkins, and then if we want to go to Ms. Hebden, that's also an opportunity.
Thank you, and Representative Kachuk, to the chair. I think that opportunity would exist to the extent that, you know, each borough, each municipal government has the prerogative to basically set their own POFD policies as they see fit. I mean, they don't need the state's blessing to institute a POFD requirement, you know, say just for certain boards and commissions that, you know, per the wisdom of people in that local government, you know, these commissions, we really do want that extra level of transparency, but for these commissions, we think it's less important. The prerogative exists for each local government to make those calls. And I believe this was communicated by Ms. Hebden, but you know, if those local governments choose to use APOC's online filing program, they're welcome to. I think that was the official response. So, you know, in the North Slope borough, if you know, if there's, you know, a couple of commissions that were deemed very important to have that POFD requirement, that fully the prerogative and decision that the North Slope Borough can make, and they could access APOC's online filing program as if that were the local preference.
Representative Puckatuck, does that satisfy your question, or would you like a follow-up there?
Yeah, it does. I guess just going on the commentary of the population threshold change, I think that I would be more in favor of the 15,000 the way it is, just because then it would mandate that my North Slope borough, for all of those boards and commissions that I don't, and maybe the borough itself doesn't feel are conflicting enough to have to require a POFD, I would actually be a lot more comfortable with that carve out aspect as far as kind of what you're self opting into. So,
thank you, Representative Buckduck. Next up, we'll go to Co-Chair Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Andreessen referenced it, and I don't know if Representative Christ Tompkins explored, you know, that perhaps it's not just the population threshold. And I'm struggling, and I'm wondering if you, as the sponsor, Representative Christ Tompkins, looked at the style of government. So including all first-class cities that have police powers and taxation powers, but excluding second-class cities or non-unified home rule boroughs. You know, the example of why we do the disclosure that comes to mind in one of the appointed positions that I can think of in my community that even by population would still need to be is someone on the Planning and Zoning Commission. It's not something you elect for. It's a volunteer position, yet lots of, turns out, local controversy about it, and there'll be the accusation of you're given this zoning exemption because you're entangled with this developer. And the answer from the local government's perspective is look at their personal financial disclosure and you'll see they do not. There is not a direct legal entanglement. Now, that doesn't always assuage a rumor mill, but it is sort of the defense of, no, this is being done above board. There is no financial benefit to that planning commissioner by making this decision. And I want to, you know, especially in first-class cities and unified first-class boroughs where we've got planning and zoning powers, property taxation powers, police powers, I think there's some assurance to the community that their government is working on their behalf, not on a personal self-interest. But again, I understand for the smallest communities, I have no problem exempting these communities that are under 1,000. To me, there's a pretty bright line on here where we don't. But 15,000 is way too high, and then hearing reference to perhaps it's not just the population, but the kind and structure of government. So, Rep. Christ Tompkins, have you thought about that in addition to a population threshold?
Representative Hannon, through the chair, I can't say we have. I'm mostly just not wanting to insert too much complexity here. I think like my sort of prior is that broadly speaking, the PUFD requirements haven't been. I totally hear you on that nexus that, you know, sort of could exist in theory, but it just seems in practice that there aren't people who are, you know, running to look up people's PUFDs on the Planning Commission to see if they're, you know, entangled with a developer who's proposing a subdivision or, you know, like name the scenario. So for me, the prior is it doesn't seem like this system has been getting a lot of traction or use. And as a result, it makes sense to sort of allow each community to figure out what they want and eliminate the state sort of blanket mandate. And I mean, differentiating different types of governments, I mean, could go there, but just given that sort of categorically, there hasn't been a lot of engagement or use or value generated by the PUFD requirements, given available information. I would sort of hesitate to sort of start breaking out different types of governments against others when it seems like more or less the reality has been the same across all types of government.
Can we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. All right, we're back on the record. We've got about 5 minutes left scheduled for our committee. I know Representative McCarty has a question, and I want to give him an opportunity to get that in. Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, the question and reflection here from hearing from many different people testifying on this, you know, the integrity and transparency is the question is whether APOC is the sole source of collecting that information. And what I'm hearing is that we have quite a few communities that have opted out, and they said, we'll take care of our own PUFD formula in the community. And so the integrity of making sure is being respected by these communities, and maybe even more communities may say, we're going to opt out. So it takes the burden off of the APOC people, as well as they've testified stating that this 15,000 population is continued to be a struggle, their own words there, and so it seems to be advice of that you make it less than, as I'm also hearing from people in the community testifying saying that we've taken care of it on our own, and I haven't heard in any testimony that this has been a problem by the opting out entities or such. And so, and then I'm hearing from the sponsor saying that there are 15,000, but they're open to, if it needs to be less than, like 10,000, that's there. So I personally am good with the 15,000. I like the discussion that's been going on here, keeping the integrity of this, but not micromanaging our community, saying we know best when they're telling us that they know best, and we want to honor that. So that's more of a statement than a question, but if there's any reflection to the by the sponsor, I'd glad to hear that.
Well, thank you for those comments, Representative McCarty. In the interest of time, I think we've got a fair understanding of where the bill sponsor is at on that, and I'd like to look to the committee to move this forward. With that, I know that the committee did receive one amendment for HB 309. Representative McCabe, would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrage. I'm not going to move Amendment 1 at this time.
Chair Schrage, I'd like to move Amendment 1.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Looking to the committee members, is there discussion on this amendment? Representative McCabe, are you wishing? No. Okay. Co-Chair Hannon, would you like to speak to the amendment?
I will. I did not have an amendment drafted because I understood that Rep. McCabe was going down the same road that I was interested in. That was reducing the population threshold from 15,000. I think it's far too high. The amendment that he had drafted is dropping it to 3,000. I completely understand that for our smallest communities, this may be overburdensome. I think for many of, you know, the majority of Alaskan municipal governments, 136, have opted out and do their own reporting. So when we're talking about the 25 that could be impacted with the current version of the bill, many of them are very functional, first-class cities and first-class boroughs, and I don't think they should be exempt. Coming down to 3,000 still incorporates at least one first-class city. I know that Skagway is, and it would still exempt them. But I think that 15,000 is far too high to shift it because a local government can opt out. I see for those very small governments that are under 1,000, perhaps they don't have enough institutional knowledge to go through the action to opt out. But for many of those larger communities, they could opt out. And I don't want to take this public disclosure information out of the record. I do understand that Amendment 1, as it's drafted, was drafted to the original version of the bill, so the lines don't line up where it's deleted, but it is simply substituting the number 3,000 for the number 15,000 throughout the bill. And I'd be totally on board with that.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hannon. And should the amendment pass, we'll provide Ledge Legal the authority to make any conforming changes. Representative Puckettuck, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know you've got a timeline to keep to, and I would say that if there was a hybrid for between the 5,000 or 3,000, whatever the number is, to 15,000, that it was the assembly folks or the ones with real authority versus mandating boards and commissions that maybe don't have authority and influence over things, that I'd be more attuned to that. So
thank you. Not seeing any further discussion, I'm going to maintain my objection. Mr. Johnston, would you please call the roll? Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Cox is not present. Representative McCarty?
No.
Representative McCabe?
No.
Representative Drummond?
Yes.
Representative Puckettuck?
No.
Co-Chair Hannon?
Yes.
Co-Chair Schrage?
No.
Two yay, four nay.
All right, and with two yeas, four nays, that amendment fails to pass. With no other amendments before us, I'd like to look to my co-chair for a motion. Here we go. I've got it for you.
Rep. Schrage, I move House Bill 309, version 32LS0540/G, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note from committee.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 309 moves from committee. I'd also like to, we don't need to say that. With that, I'd like to ask committee members to remain after we gavel out to sign the report. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, March 15th at 8 a.m., where the committee will take public testimony on HB 256 and have an introductory hearing on HB 298, Alaska Food Strategy Task Force. Regarding HB 256, the committee will be setting a deadline of Wednesday, March 15th at 4 p.m. for amendments. Please deliver amendments to Representative Hannon's office, as she will have the gavel next week. With nothing else to come before the committee, we are adjourned at 10:02 a.m.